Welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived. The People's Podcast is here. Let's go for a ride with some Fozzie. Stroll down memory lane right there from the Chasing the Grail record back in 2010. That is Watch Me Shine, which is a set of lyrics that I wrote back in 1993 for the Great Caesar's Ghost demo that I did. And that was called You Can't Change the World, I believe is what it was called. So there you go. And now we repackaged it, rewrote it, and it was called Watch Me Shine. Big, big hit. One of the Miz's favorite Fozzie tunes. And today, speaking of Fozzie, we recorded William Regal at a Fozzie concert in Atlanta months and months and months ago. We played center stage with Theory of a Dead Man. Darren was there rocking out to Fozzie, no matter what he says. I saw him. I saw him rocking. I know deep down inside he's a Fozzie fan, no matter how tough and rough he wants to be on the Twitter. But it's all right, man. We got him today on Talk is Jericho. We talk about all kinds of stuff. His early years in England, his early years in World Championship Wrestling, his initial tryout for the WWE, the British wrestling scene and the guys who influenced him, coming to America for the first time, and it's not the Eddie Murphy movie. Hello, New York City, I love you! Shut up! You shut up too, or whatever it was. Yes, I haven't seen that in a while, but we had a great discussion with Mr. Regal. Had a lot of laughs too. He's a big comedy guy speaking of comedy. I wonder if he's like, hopefully he likes Nothing to Report better than he likes Fozzy. I know Nothing to Report's a huge hit, over 300,000 views already in under a week. The new Comedy Central web series that's sweeping the nation with Team Tiger Awesome, the guys who wrote and created the show. You can hear them on last week's podcast, last week's Talk is Jericho, and last week being Wednesday. I don't even know what days the shows are on. Great, great show. You got to go check this out. Nick Mundy, Clint Gage, Michael Truly were great on Talk is Jericho, and they're all great on Nothing to Report. ComedyCentral.com or YouTube. Go check it out. If it does well, if you guys support it and the views keep racking up, we will do more shows. Comedy Central has already said that. So give your thoughts, give your likes, and give your love to Nothing to Report. And give your love to me, because I got William Regal standing by. But first, last night, talking about England, I went and saw one of England's finest bands of all time. I went to see The Who. And I was really, really surprised with how good they were. I mean, I think The Who, when you're talking about kind of the classic bands from that era, get a little bit underrated. You know, they play their set and every song's a hit. And even a couple songs they played that weren't hits were like some real deep Who tracks, like A Quick One While He's Away, which is about a 10-minute song. I know Mike Portnoy loves that one. They did Amazing Journey and Sparks from the Tommy record. That's about another 8, 9, 10 minutes. I forgot how proggy The Who is. They got a lot of twists and turns in some of their songs, and how heavy The Who is. I mean, Pete Townsend, man, what a great guitar player. And even, you know, at 70 years old, obviously not jumping around like they used to, but still good energy. Roger Daltrey's vocals were incredible. He didn't miss any notes and still had a lot of power. I mean, that big scream on Won't Get Fooled Again, the money shot that everyone's waiting for, he nailed it, and people cheered, you know. Yeah! Meet the new boss! And people are like, ah! So that was cool. But the thing, the secret ingredient for me, the secret weapon, was obviously Keith Moon passed away, you know, 1978, years and years and years ago. But they have now a guy on drums called Zach Starkey. And if Starkey sounds familiar, that's because that's Ringo Starr's real last name. So he's been playing in The Who for a while. He's Ringo's son. And he looks like Ringo, especially facially while he's playing, kind of that stoic, weird, quirky face. And he plays like Keith Moon. I mean, obviously nobody can play like Keith Moon exactly, but he is such a hard-hitting drummer. And those drum parts are so crazy. So it was really cool to watch him play and watch him do his thing. So really great show. If you get a chance to see him, go see him. And it kind of reminded me of all the other bands I'm going to be seeing this summer. Joan Jett opened for The Who, which was a real kind of a random opening band choice, but I thought she was crazy good. She really killed it. And she's going to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this weekend, and I will be there. Wise Cousin Chad and myself are going there. Thanks to Betsy from Rolling Stone magazine who hooked us up. We met her last year at the Barclay Center, and Joan's going to be getting in, and we'll give you an on the spot report. Hopefully, maybe if Chad and I get a chance after we see the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame show to fill you in on that. But she was great, and like I said, some of the bands I'm going to see this summer is Rush, if I can make it, AC/DC. I'm going to go see the Stones again. Van Halen, all those bands are like in their 60s and 70s. It's crazy how all those bands are still touring. Some of them sound better than others, but still, they're out there and they're drawing crowds. So super excited to see AC/DC with my friend Chris Slade on drums. Obviously, they killed it at Coachella. I was going to watch the live stream because they had a live stream for all the bands except for AC/DC, who probably made it dark so that you can't watch it and post it and all that sort of stuff. They want it to be a surprise. Great set list on DC's part, too, playing Have a Drink on Me and Sin City. And they kept Rock and Roll Train in the set, which is cool. It's the first new song since Thunderstruck that's been on two consecutive tours, which is pretty crazy. And then obviously Rush, 40th anniversary. It's their last tour, so they say. Van Halen just out of nowhere goes on tour. I tried to get David Lee Roth. I tried to get Wolfgang Van Halen, but Van Halen's publicist won't allow it yet. Van Halen's publicist is actually Eddie's wife, Janie, and they kind of turned us down. So maybe not Talk is Jericho fans, but I'll keep trying. I always get what I want, never take what for an answer. Never take no for an answer, Tommy. What movie's that from? Yeah, so it's going to be a great summer of some pure rock and roll. The Stones back again. That should be good. But I was really, really excited about The Who. Very, very happy that I got to see them. And I think that you need to go check them out as well. So lots of cool stuff coming up. That was your little rock and roll lesson. Excited to be going out with Slash in May with Fozzy. Going out with Kiss in October with Fozzy. And then, of course, April 24th in Atlanta at 37 Main, April 25th. Welcome to Rockville. Got a lot of cool podcast guests lined up, and I'm going to keep on rolling. You know what I'm going to do that? I'm going to keep on rolling. Summer's here, man.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, so we are, I'm here with, it's funny because I never know exactly what to call you. William Regal, Steve Regal, Darren is what I usually call you.
Yes.
Your real name. Do you still consider yourself Steve Regal?
Yes, I always have done.
It's interesting because he's been William Regal for like 15 years now at least.
Yeah, or 13, yeah, and I still, no, 14. I still introduce right. myself as Steve Regal.
So you've been William longer than...
About the same. I started as Steve Regal in 1986.
Okay.
Before that, from like 83 till 86, I had a different name every day.
Okay.
Depending what they thought was funny, whoever was writing
like,
the bill.
Like what? Like give me a couple.
Bertie Bassett was the one they used to think was hilarious for some reason or another. I was Mick Maloney, the Scrapman's kid, for a while. I like Dave Levine.
Just random Dave Levine?
Dave Levine, and that didn't go anywhere. But
there was, I remember Bruce Hart used to do that. They had Ben Dover and Phil McCracken.
Yeah, it was Drew McDonald, wasn't it? Drew McDonald. Drew McDonald was Ben Doone McDonald when he was in...
Ben Doone and Phil McCracken.
Yeah, when he was in Calgary.
why did you have to change from Steve to William when you came to the WWE?
They just asked me, because it started off as Steve and William Regal for the first week or so that me and you were doing something from the first couple of weeks, and then it was just, do you mind being William? I think because of Steve Austin, right?
I was
fine with it. I'm more than happy because I really wanted to completely start again. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I've been in a lot of trouble, and it was like, let's just start again and see where it goes. And my granddad's name's William. My eldest son Daniel, his middle name's William. So I was quite happy with it. Yeah, I didn't. They just gave me the name, and I was really happy with it. So
Vince was going through that phase where if there was one, like Steve, obviously Steve, so you can't even have any more Steves.
Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah,
though,
it
really.
Is.
Yeah,
I remember even my finish used to be called the Lion Tamer, and Ken Shamrock had the Lion's Den. So Vince says we have too many lions around here, so that's how it became Walls of Jericho. But we're here right now. You can kind of hear some noodling upstairs. We're in the basement of Center Stage
at a
Fozzy show, and you came very graciously to come hang out. And we're in the basement as they sound check. But Center Stage, not only a musical venue, but a famous
wrestling place,
famous wrestling film TV here for years with WCW.
WCW. I can't believe you've never been here.
I've never been here ever.
It must have been right about the cutoff time that you came. That stopped coming here.
I think that was the first.
Well. My very first day in WCW was the 25th of January 1993. And I walked in the doors upstairs and I was told to ask for Dusty Rhodes. So I asked for Dusty Rhodes and I got pointed into one of those little rooms up there. And I knocked on the door and I had come in and I walked in and Dusty was sat there naked except for a pair of cowboy boots. Absolutely bollock naked. And remember Doug Dillinger?
Yes, Doug Dillinger, the head of security.
So Doug Dillinger sat next
miserable.
To him. Right, well, Doug Dillinger sat next to him. And I said, hello, Mr. Rhodes, I'm Steve Regal. And I'd always been Steve Regal, right? And he looked up at me. He was absolutely naked except for a pair of cowboys. And he went, Steven, I'm just like Whitney Houston. I got my own bodyguard. And that was it. And he just carried on looking at his papers. And I went... Well, there we go. And I just walked out, and that was the first day on the job.
You never found out what he meant?
No.
Okay.
That was it.
And they filmed TV here for years and years and years.
Yeah, so this was my place. I mean, the big run that I had when I first got here is, well, first few months were a bit suspect when they just wanted me to be me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really working because... He was working on the house shows, on the live events, because I got to go out and do me, right? But when I got here, Bill Watts brought me to America, and I was told, like, we don't need to really be a baby face or a villain. Just go out and be one of those English wrestlers.
What do you mean, like doing like chain wrestling? And
yeah,
whatever,
well,
yeah.
That's what I do, right?
Yeah.
But then they went, first day. 3 minutes. Yeah, what? So I've never done it. And this 10 years before I got here. I mean, literally all over the world except for coming to
States,
America.
Yeah.
I've never done any less than five rounds. I don't, you know, that's what
which
I do.
How long was a round?
5 minutes. It depending where you went, but mostly 5 minutes.
So you're looking at 20, 30, 40
yeah,
minute
I mean,
matches.
You can only do that stuff. So eventually I became Lord Stephen. Well, this was my place here. You know, I had a lot of heat getting it, you know, coming in and out of here, and that was before you got there, really. That was like 93 94 95.
Yeah, because I started in 96.
Yeah, and this was the place then, you know. This was the,
because where we switched the TV tapings, like, you know, I guess it was called WCW Worldwide or
yes.
Saturday Night.
Well, this was Saturday Night. This is where we did Saturday Night.
We started going to the outskirts of Atlanta, Dalton,
yes.
Georgia. I believe Dalton,
we
Georgia.
We did that. Yeah, we used to do the Sunday Night Show, the main event.
Yeah.
And then we used to do the Worldwides. And then eventually we started doing, well, the end of 93, we started doing the Worldwides in Orlando.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so, yeah. You know, that continued either at Disney or Universal, one of the two. That it was different sometimes.
Yeah, MGM, whatever it
yeah,
was.
But MGM,
I remember my
yeah.
first WCW show ever was in Dalton, Georgia, and I met you there.
Yeah.
Because originally, I think Benoit had asked you to come pick me up at the airport, or there was some kind of miscommunication pre-cell phone days. Because I remember I saw you, and you're like, oh, I was waiting to get the call to pick you up or whatever it was. And it was like, you know, any friend of Chris is a friend of mine, sort of thing. So right off the bat, I vividly remember you were the first guy I ever met because you were wearing dress clothes, and I was like, "Oh man, am I underdressed?" Like, no one told me what to do.
No, that was just me, you know.
Yeah,
I was,
right.
I
to this day,
yeah.
To this day, how did you? You mentioned that Watts brought you in here
yes.
back in '93 after 10 years or whatever it was of working all around the world.
Yes.
How did you finally end up getting brought over here?
Okay.
And also, why did it take you so long?
Well, first, I say I started in 83. That was when I had my first match, my first few matches. I was 15. And then I left school at 16, 8 days after I turned 16. Because in England, you finish high school at 16. Right? Mm-hmm. It's just the way it is. And if you're working class, you go out and get a job in a factory or whatever you're going to do. And so I went away, left home and became because I was already had the connection with the wrestling. I went and became a wrestler. But first year and a half, I didn't really know anything. I just worked with the same two fellas all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can only learn so much.
Right.
And they did taught me all they could. And then a lot of different things happened. I'm under no illusion about how I got to travel the world. And that's because I'm 6'3".
Hmm.
And that's the truth of
and
it.
And you were a good-looking guy, too, at the time.
Well, but it's just 6'3". You get noticed, you know, to get outside of England at that time, there was only so many guys went. There was that group of heavyweight guys. There was the junior guys in the early days, Dynamite and Rocco and people that went to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, it was that pretty real close shop of, because most of the heavyweight guys never worked in England.
Right, right.
They'd only work a few months of the year in England. Like Dave Taylor was the globe-trotting guy. You know, people don't know what kind of life he had.
Dave Taylor, pretty underrated.
Just
performer.
You know, he didn't come to America till he was 40, but you know, he was wrestling from when he was in his teens to, and he went more places than anybody. He was in so much demand because they used to, all these other countries around the world, they used to love bringing in these British guys, heavyweight guys that could wrestle their guys for long periods.
Because like, there was a style, like you mentioned, Watts said, the British
yes.
style.
Yes.
Because I remember even watching Stampede Wrestling, a lot of
yes.
guys from England would come through there, and there was a certain style that you could see.
Yeah.
You know,
very technical and believable.
Right.
And that was, it gave the promotions credibility to have that kind of hard-hitting, credible style. And
but
if you could go to India.
Too.
Sorry?
Because some good flying,
some good
too.
Yeah,
you know, not just all mat work.
Yeah, I mean, believe it or not, I was diving over the top rope when I was, my flying days ended when I was 21 21 in Krefeld in Germany. And I used to do that. Suicide dive.
Just straight over the top
rope.
Top rope, yeah.
Yeah, and a certain German fella, literally, as I'm coming over the top rope, he's just swallowed it and just gone and bottled it and like moved away. And I just hit,
wow.
I hit the floor. My hand hit his shoulder. My head hit the floor and it just completely tore out my shoulder. Like,
and that was it.
Completely dislocated my shoulder. And it was actually hanging in my chest, the bone.
It just completely unraveled.
It just unraveled, yeah. So that was the end of my flying days, right? That
you learned
was
a lesson.
Simple as that, learned a lesson. But so I worked in Blackpool and in the surrounding areas till I was 17 and a half. Then I met Marty Jones, who was the best guy in Britain, right? He was just fantastic wrestler. The top guy over there at the time, him and Finlay were the two top guys that were getting, they wrestled each other all the time. Marty had that incredible match with Owen, if you've never seen it.
Oh, yes.
Right.
It's on YouTube.
It was just so much advanced for its time, you know. But Marty took a liking to me and sort of retrained me. I used to train with him and then he sort of retrained me. But also at the same time, I met Robbie Brookside. And Robbie was 2 years older than me and he'd gone to work for bigger promotions and had wrestled all these, because you only get better at this when you wrestle better people, if you've got no natural ability. And I had no natural ability for this at all.
Really? You weren't an athlete
terrible.
At all?
No, not in the slightest. No, usually I did a bit of, I wanted to do this from being as early ages, so there was no amateur wrestling where I lived. So it was I did some judo and I did some boxing, and I was not good at either, but it was just to get fit and do something for this. I never did anything knowing I'm not a competitive person, which probably to my detriment as in this business. But honestly, I'm not a sportsman, not care about being better than anybody. I just did me.
Yeah,
that's all I've ever done, and it's probably, you know, I've always looked at this as a career, and I've never really gone that, because I just do me.
You weren't really much of a political player, being
a
cutthroat.
That's just not my thing. I just do me. I just go out and try to be the best I can do for me, right? And do my little, live in my little world of just go out and do what I can and try and be different.
But you always had a big character, though. I mean, you obviously understood the personality side.
See, that was my thing, or the wrestling or whatever. Right. I know what I can do, but back then I was never a competitor. If you want to, people go, oh, you want to be better than me, good for you. Mm-hmm. You know, like somebody's always got to try and, you know, the competitive.
Yeah.
Good for you. Go on. That's good for you. I'll just keep doing me. So I met Robbie. So the stuff that Marty was teaching me, I started to wrestle Robbie a lot in wrestling matches, because there was a lot of those in England, like competitive sort of babyface matches.
And Robbie, just for those who don't know, actually now he's a trainer down in NXT.
Yeah.
But long blonde hair. He had
short hair.
Oh, did he at the time? Yeah. But very, very much a mainstay of the English kind of independent scene. Everybody knows
him. Well, there was no such thing as independent then. He was it was just the scene.
Sure, the scene, right. There was no WWE, it was just the English scene, right.
So, Robbie was 2 years older than me, and he'd started at the same place as me on the fairground in Blackpool, but within a short period of time, he'd gone to work for Brian Dixon, who was a lot bigger promoter.
Mm-hmm.
Brian had some incredible talent. Well, if you doesn't matter what you get taught, unless you're on with somebody better than you, you only get to a certain level. Well, Robbie got put on with really good people all the time and got schooled really well, so he learned when to do the right things, the right time.
Mm-hmm.
So I started wrestling Robbie at 17, and most of the fellas wouldn't give you nothing, you see. Fellas I was on with, they just had their matches and they wouldn't really do a lot. They didn't want to try anything new.
Mm-hmm.
But then me and him started doing these wrestling matches, 6 5-minute rounds, no falls. Everything was 2 out of 3 falls. Well, within a few, no, this is not the right time to do that. So you can do all these moves and that, but it's knowing how to do and when to do and get the most effect out of them. That happened. I got a break and got onto working on the World of Sports shows when I was 18.
And that was a big deal.
That was the TV
show in England.
I quit after 3 months.
Why?
I got put in Big Daddy tag matches, which everybody thought was a great role to have. But when I started, I just wanted to work on a fairground in Blackpool. I thought it was the greatest job in the world, right? Living in Wonderland, right? But then I started seeing, like, Pete Roberts, who was my idol and as a heavyweight guy from England. He wasn't really a heavyweight guy, but he was considered one. Dave Taylor and people like him. They were the two guys, and a guy called Terry Rudge. And they were the guys that they were going to places all the time. They were in Germany for so many months a year. They were in Japan. They were in South Africa. They were going to India. It just all sounded very exotic to me. That's what I want to do. So, and I was getting tall. You know, I was tall by then, and I was starting to fill out a little bit, you know. And I thought, I want to do that style. But that was a select group of fellas. But Marty was teaching me all this wrestling stuff. Robbie was helping me do it in front of a crowd. So I found out, you know, I'd say it a lot, but you only get good at this falling on your backside 1,000 times, right?
Yeah.
Unless you know it works. It doesn't matter if this, it drives me nuts when I hear people nowadays and they come out, different TV, TV's a different animal, right? Because you're working for the cameras. But if you're on a live event and you come out and you go, crowd was rotten tonight, that drives me. No, you were rotten. Because you didn't change up what you were doing. That crowd is entitled to do anything they want to do. It's up to you to change it.
And that was kind of how you learned, of just that going out there and just calling it all in the ring.
Right. You had to.
No real high spots or anything.
No, but, you know, you'd have a few little things, little sequences. We didn't call them ice. It was sequences.
Sequences?
Yeah, a few little sequences. You'd have a few little things, but it was just that wrestling stuff. And by today's standards, people wouldn't really watch it, but they didn't know any better then. That was what they knew. So
yeah,
that's what you did. But it was very technically based and solid looking and, you know, different kinds of British wrestling. But what I was trying to do was to be this believable wrestling style.
Yeah.
But I also love the entertainment people who did that. And not that I did a lot of that, but I always was fascinated with how they could control the audience and as villains.
Who was like a really good character back in that time?
My favorite, as far as wrestlers go, it's a separate thing, but wrestlers was... my favorite wrestler of all time and favorite wrestler to ever wrestle was a guy called Terry Rudge.
He had a good character.
He looked like, he just looked like a wrestler should look and wrestled like a wrestler. And you could believe it, right? But my favorite was a guy called Cyanide Sid Cooper, who was like the best. And also Jimmy Breaks. I never really give Jimmy any credit because I never... But I used to watch them, and they were, you know, not big fellas, but they used to have so much heat from just... And Jimmy could get really nasty heat, but could also switch to a bit of comedy in there and turn it right back around. And Sid was great at doing a lot of comedy, same thing, but when he'd turn it on, people would get... I mean, want to kill him. And as a kid, I remember that, you know, because I always gravitated as a kid going to wrestling. I used to love watching the villains, right? And even though I loved them, when the matches were on, I'd be laughing, and then I'd get me screaming, and then I used to start analysing it and go, that's fantastic, yeah. Alan Feltz. Because all I ever, you know, I was never into sports at all, still not. All I was interested in was wrestling and British comedy and
right, I was going to say, you've always had that very funny side to your character.
I used to marvel at these guys. I like watching these guys, these comedians on TV.
Like which comedians?
Well, it was just never ending. Like in England, you got the two Ronnies and Morecambe and Wise and people that, and Tommy Cooper and people that were just
talking about Fawlty Towers.
I mean, it was just never ending amount of stuff, right? And but you watched it and go, I love these comedians, but these wrestlers are not only making people hate them, but they're making them laugh at them, and then they're using that. When they laugh at them, they'll turn that around and make them hate them even more and then look at the crowd like, you're laughing at me? Well, he's going to cop for this now. I'm going to beat him up because you laughed at me. And what a marvelous... I used to be sitting there at 7 and 8 years old going, that's what I
want
to do.
You figured it out right away.
Well, I didn't figure out what the workings of the industry, but I figured out what they were doing.
What you liked, yeah.
What I liked. And I always tell people that today when I'm working with, don't ever forget what you liked as a child. Because once you get to a smart age, you start forgetting what you liked as a kid. And you don't like to admit it, right? You don't like to go, well, I like that, because it's maybe not what's the cool thing to do, because maybe those fellas aren't the best in-ring guys or whatever. But if you can keep a little bit of everything in your act, which is what we are,
that's
as an
great
act,
point.
Right?
Yeah.
You can, good, you know, you figure out what you're good at and what you're not good at. Do the things you're good at. Avoid the things you can't, but if you can keep a bit of, okay, let me keep those group of fans happy there, let me keep that group there, let me keep these families happy, but let me give that kid there, that little child, something to scream at and or whatever else to make his day that somebody's going to beat me up at the end of it, and keep something that, because that's what's our audience made up of in the WWE, right? most of it is a lot of families with a lot of children that want to buy. And I always looked at it like that. Well, they're never going to want to buy an action figure of me, but they're going to want to buy one. They've got to buy somebody for somebody to beat up. Yeah. Right, you know, and so you try these different things. So it's a long story.
No, but I mean, but the thing is, it doesn't have to be that, because what I was going to say is that you've always had this real diverse side. You can go out there and kick ass, but you also had one of the best comedic characters in the WWE history, like when you were the general manager. Yeah, so much funny stuff, because you understood that side of it. You never took yourself too seriously.
Absolutely not.
You know,
I mean, it's part. I think that's just part of being British growing up. You don't.
That's right.
I'm very self-deprecating.
Take the piss.
Exactly. Yeah, because you can't. You'd never get through life.
Remember, we did the thing. It's the famous thing where I peed in your tea.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that was still. If you haven't seen it, go YouTube it if you can. But the deal was that you were the general manager and I was, whatever, we were having some kind of an issue, and I went in there and peed in your tea.
Yes.
And then you drank it, and your face, man, still one of the funniest moments, the face that you made when you drank the tea. Well,
it's buying into your character as well, though, isn't it? You've got to really, I tell people that. I got given, we mentioned Pete Roberts before, but two bits of advice from him, and they were the best bits of advice I was ever given. The first thing, make everything you do mean something else. Don't bother doing it, which is a never-ending. You never stop, and you'll constantly work on the detail if you're thinking about that. Analyze why you do it, what's the reason behind. But the other thing was, every single night you go out there, never assume anybody knows who you are. Mm. Every night you are working to, just imagine, everybody out there has never seen you before. You've got to make them understand why they should not like you, or why they should love you, or what you are doing, and make it easy for them to understand. And if you do that, you come out with that look. You know, you're not playing at that. You're never playing at your character. You're never playing at what you do. You come out believing in it. When I'm in total villain mode, there's a difference. There's a comedic side, and when I'm in total, I'm truly, look, everybody out there to me, they are totally beneath me. I'm not playing at that. That's how it comes
through. It's method acting, yeah.
And it comes through in your eyes, right? Because I always say this about three things. It starts in your brain, it goes into your heart, and it comes out on your eyes. Mm. And if one of those things isn't working, people figure out. You can get by so long on it. You've got to believe what you're doing, else you're just playing at this, right? Anyway, off that, back onto this thing of 18, Big Daddy's tag partner, don't want to be there.
Great. You want to travel the world.
Well, great. Yeah, you're on I just started getting on TV a few times. I think I did a few World of Sports. I was only there 3 months, and I quit. Because Brian Dixon had just as many shows. But he had all the best talent. And I was talking to, you probably remember Robbie Stewart, Chick Cullen.
He was in Calgary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking to him one night at one of Joint Promotions, which was Big Daddy's brother's shows, right? And I said, I'm just not happy. And he said, well, why don't you call Brian? He said, I'll talk to him tomorrow. And I didn't know that Robbie had already spoke to Brian. So I called Brian, and Brian said to me, what, you insane? You're on TV with Big Daddy, you know, like the top spot. I said, look, I want to get better. He said, well, I promise you, I'll put you on with somebody better than you every night. And so I quit at 18, which I had to call up the top promoter in England saying, I'm quitting.
At 18 years old.
How I did that, I have no idea. But it
and
just
working in main events, too.
Yeah.
Because Big Daddy was the big star.
I mean, we say main events, the shine had gone off Big Daddy Roadshow by then, right? It was different, right, by then. The heyday would have been like 6 years before that.
Okay. But it still had the name.
But it was still a name, and that was just being in
at
that
18,
spot.
Yeah.
I just thought of something. I was in this one tag, and this was one of those things. In Llandudno in Wales, Llandudno as it's pronounced. And it was me and Daddy against, it might have been Drew McDonald and another guy called Rex Strong, and Rex Strong was from Blackpool. And Rex is like a 350-pound monster, right? But he used to wrestle as Rex Strong, and all of a sudden he'd been away for a while, and he came back and he wrestled. He's 350-pound, right? Barely moved around, and he was in a black mask and suit and called the Ninja. So, and he picks, like, all he did was do the selling and make the tag to Daddy. Well, he picks me. He was so lovely fella, and still is, Barry, a lovely man. Picked me up as gently as could be and put me upside down in their corner, and just like, in the what people call the tree of woe now, and just basically just took my foot under the and give me these kicks that couldn't have broke the skin on her ice pudding, you know, like just hazada, just these. And there's like about 150 old grandmothers in, and Big Daddy shouted at the top of his voice, "What a lovely fella!" And I'm like, "Oh, this is brutal." I was just like, wanting to crawl up my own backside.
What did he say too about the sweets and the cakes and everything?
Oh, I haven't got time to tell you that. That's another hour on its own.
Did you have the strawberry shortcake?
Yeah. I'm not going to give that one away because that's the best bit in me when I do me one man shows.
Oh, okay.
In England.
That's
a 20 minute piece there. Anyway,
yes, Daddy.
So I quit and I went to work for Brian. Well, all of a sudden, I'm on with wrestling Rollerball Rocco and like all these great fellas.
The best, right.
So you're learning, learn. Well, I'm getting bigger, I'm getting heavier. And then all of a sudden, it started putting me on with the heavyweights that I wanted to be on. So I'm wrestling Dave Taylor, I'm wrestling Pete Roberts, I'm wrestling Lee Bronson, Tony Sinclair. And I'm like...
So none of those guys were on World of Sport?
Yeah, they were, yeah. Oh, okay. They're all on it, but they weren't on it a lot because they traveled.
Gotcha, I understand, okay.
You know, like...
You wanted to be part of the traveling.
You wanted part of the traveling thing. It's didn't make any money in England. You didn't travel. You 2,000 miles a week sat in a car, you know. Mm-hmm. So I started wrestling them, and then by the time I was 19... But the thing is, like I say, it's back to that. I was 6'3", and there's very few people that are 6'3" in England. There's a lot of people just as good as me. Mm-hmm. Like even Robbie. Robbie's 6'2", but he's very thin.
Thin, yeah.
And so they wouldn't book him on them German tournaments, and you know what I mean? There was a lot of that nonsense. Well, I just got bigger and heavier and, you know, training and whatever else. And I was, you know, up to about 17 stone, and by the time I was 19... All of a sudden, that's when I started getting into, you know, working with these fellas, getting good at that. And it was like the difference in the 87. By the time 88 rolled around, I'm sort of, people are noticing me. And then I get word about going to Germany that one year, and people used to block you a lot, right? They didn't want you in because if you go in, they might lose the job.
Spot,
you know, you went to, what year did you go to?
I was
Hamburg?
In Germany in 93.
Okay, well, I went first in 88. And the only reason I got in is another key thing to my success that got me the first time in Germany. Dave Taylor, and I'm forever grateful. Dave was the main guy in Hamburg, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Dave got offered to go to Hanover, which was another Otto Vance's thing.
Yeah, Hamburg was kind of the smaller territory.
And then Hanover was the big one. So Dave got offered to go there, so Dave put me into his spot. That's the only way I got that spot when I was 20. I just, that summer as well, that was in the autumn of 88, but that summer I got booked to go to France. I did 6 weeks in France.
Wow. I never knew France really had much
its
own company.
It used to be huge, and then it died off, and then they'd started running again.
Oh, okay.
And then we did France all over, everywhere. It was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. One day we did 5 days and didn't go to bed once. We just sat in a car driving.
Wow,
like one end of the other.
And that's hard. That's something a lot of people don't realize is the travel.
Yeah.
Like the shows are the fun part, but the traveling a lot of times.
That was
very
that was
taxing.
Really,
very
really
difficult.
I mean, up and down, whoever booked that was... It was just one end of France to the other, to the right down that you'd been like Saint-Tropez, and then right up to the Belgian border, and you know, non-stop. It was mad. And this one lady wrestler just drove the whole time. She must have been, I don't know, she
hopped
was
up on something,
something like she was. She just drove the non-stop. We'd just literally get there, 15 hours, do the show, and then jump in the car, and she'd drive. And Richie Brooks, another English, like we were the only two English guys on it. So I get to Hamburg, blah blah blah. Things started kicking off for me then, and all of a sudden I'm 20. Everything started taking off. Word got about. I started getting booked in. I got booked in South Africa at the beginning of 89. Then I got booked in different places. Then Bremen the first time for Otto Vance, and then because that was so hard to get in on that.
Right,
gig.
That was a big place to be.
That was a big point.
So you're basically working every
everywhere.
Big territory you
yes.
can work in,
and
except
with
for
all
States.
The best people, right?
Right.
And that was basically. When you were in Hamburg, was Frans van Buiten still there?
No, he was not. I think he was in
Hamburg. When I went there, he was in his 50s, and he was fantastic. He was good. Like Errol Flynn, I've probably told you this, right? But my first day in Hamburg, I'm, you know, people, the prestige of going, people, when you got there, you went, oh, it's a circus tent on a car park. But it was a big deal to get out. Mm-hmm. That was a big deal to get to Hamburg.
Yeah,
you know?
To get booked there was a
to
big deal.
To get booked, yeah. Deal, you know. And I'm sat there on this bench in at the back of this tent. And he looks like he just big grin on his face, and he drops his trousers. I'm like 3 foot away from him, and this thing fell out, and I just wanted to applaud him, you know. And I say it, but it, like, it looked like Popeye's forearm just fell out like that, and I'm thinking, my God, what am I doing here, you know?
Is that what you need, one of those to make it in the business?
Yeah, and I'm in the wrong job here, you know. I think is this what they're all like, all these Germans and these Europeans? But it was a big deal. And that year when I went, that was when it was still really on form. You know, it was business right. Was great. There was Franz Van Buyten there. I got to wrestle him. He was just a masterclass in trying to hold on. Mm-hmm. You'd put him in headlock, and you'd have to just keep him in an headlock for 5 minutes. He'd be kicking and strong, but he'd make you keep it on him, and you just learn how to work hold and really keep people.
Yeah, the word rest hold is not what it's supposed to be.
No, absolutely not.
It's a wear down hold.
Oh,
yeah.
God, that's... drives me nuts, that. Yeah. It just working and work. And Terry Rudge was there, who was, like I say, me and Finley both say Terry's the best wrestler we've ever wrestled.
Wow.
That's how good Terry Rudge was.
And no name value whatsoever in the States, basically.
No.
Never came over
but
here.
Just fantastic. Indio was on his game.
Indio, then.
But, you know, he was a bit older. But he'd have been 50 when I was there, but he was still right on his game there.
Where was he from? Brazil or something?
Colombia.
Indio Guajardo was his name,
yeah,
the guy in Germany.
Fantastic, yeah.
But he was a Colombian.
By the time you got there, you know, it's 5 years later. He's probably nearly 60 by the time you got there.
I remember I gave him a suplex and someone after went, I can't believe that you suplexed Indio. No one's got him off his feet in like years.
Well, also, as you know, who booked you, that's when I got to meet René Lazetez. Mm-hmm. And René had a big influence on me. Just
in what way?
The character for when I came to America. I just used to watch him. I mean, he was 60 then, right? Just the way he controlled the audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'd just stand there and do the...
I used to do the presence.
Great, you know, he just carried himself so well, and just the timing that he didn't do a lot of anything. But I saw him that year, and you can probably find bits of this on YouTube. I know there's a fantastic chain match with Dave Taylor and Franz Van Buyten. But René used to do hour chain matches with Van Buyten. Mm-hmm. Were they doing the chain matches still when you were there? The flags and stuff.
Yep.
And but they captivate. I mean, it's only 800 people or 1,000, whatever they could get in there. But just the way he used to do things, and I thought, I was always thinking, well, one day I'll be work as a villain, you know. I used to work as a villain certain countries I went to, but it was just wrestling villain. But I thought, if ever... this character would be a mixture of René and Cyanide Sid. Mm. The bit of comedy and that with this arrogance and all that other stuff. So it all kept going. 91, I get a call from... I get a letter from WWE to go and try out for them, unbeknownst to me. Terry Rudge, who hadn't seen Al Hayes for 20 years since he'd left England, called him up. And said, there's this lad that without me knowing, there's this lad, it must have cost a fortune in them days as well, right?
To call long distance.
Yeah. Called him up at the office in Stanford. I got this lad, a good lad, obviously
big.
Tall, big, does a good job in the ring. I get a letter, unbeknownst to me, I get this letter come from, which I've told the story before and that. But get this letter, go to the Royal Albert Hall, have a tryout match for him. They said, we like you, but it was at the time when... that everybody had a character, and you know, they'd bring people in when they need them, so we'll keep you on fire. Then, the few weeks after that, I get a call from Orig Williams, a Welsh promoter, that WCW were coming and they wanted to see A-Stax, Giant A-Stax, and asked me to go to work with him because I worked with him all the time at that time. I seemed to be working with for about 18 months. Everywhere I went, I was working with him. If I was in Britain, I was working with him. It seemed to be with him a lot, right?
And they brought him in as the Loch Ness Monster.
Well, that was ages later.
Okay.
This was just a separate thing. So they wanted. So I got to go, and we're there the first night, and something happened. I think Scott Hall was there, definitely, but I think he's never told me whether it was him or not, and I've asked him, and he just, like, shrugged it off. somebody didn't, or they didn't bring somebody on tour or something like that. And so Scott, I think, put me in and said, instead of just working the one night, can you do the whole 5 days?
Oh, okay.
And so I called Brian Dixon and I said, look, do you mind? No, he said, no, you stay. So I got to work on the tour, which was like 5 days in, well, 4 days in Britain and then 1 day in Ireland.
Who'd you work with?
First night was with Michael Hayes, then with Jimmy Garvin, then with Stax, then with Terry Taylor, then with Oz.
Nash.
With Kevin, yeah.
How was it working with those guys, like the American style? Yeah.
I get a bit...
You didn't like that?
I get eaten up when people go, he's got a different style. Mm-hmm. I never had any problems working with fellas that came from that period of time because they all know what they do.
It's, right, it's if just, you can work, you can work.
Yes. Yeah. It doesn't matter. I used to go all over the world and work with people. Literally couldn't, never spoke to them, couldn't speak the language.
Yes.
If you're basically trained right, if I...
Of course.
Turn your arm one way, it goes that way.
Yeah.
You know, as you know, when all the luchas came to WCW, who worked with them?
Yeah.
I was the only guy that hadn't been to Mexico that worked
yeah,
with them, right?
That's right, yeah.
You worked with them and obviously and Dean and Chris, but it was me, yeah. Right? Because I could figure out, I didn't have to speak to them. Just
international language.
International language.
Exactly.
And it's people don't get trained, right? And, mm-hmm. and then they can... get upset about that, but it's the truth. That never a problem in those days. So
when you did that tour,
they said they liked me. So I was like, well, whatever. The next year, I went about my business. I was booked solidly. I was away out of England for 9 months all wow. over the place. I went to South Africa, Egypt, Germany, Austria, India, and then... In the September of 92, Rip Rogers was on that tour in Germany, and he said, I've heard Bill Watts has got into WCW. Send this letter. Mm-hmm. He likes handwritten letters and that. You know, I said, can you have a good night? Yeah, I'll get there. So I wrote a handwritten letter. Used to have to go to the phone box to call. It was about a quarter of a mile away to get to call home every day. So I called my wife, and she said, Bill Watts... his secretary's been on the phone. It's like a week later. I called him and he said, can you start straight away? And I said, well, no. He said, why not? I said, I'm booked here till Christmas. He said, have you got a contract? I said, no. And the line went dead. And he went, you've definitely got the job now. And I went, well, and that was it. I said, I got a handshake deal. And he went all silent. He went, you've definitely got the job. He said, most people would have walked out on anybody. And that, I think that's what sealed the deal with me. It meant a lot to him, right? So by the time they got my visas and everything, it was... they wanted me to start on the 1st of January. By the time they got my visas and that, I started, as I said, on the 25th of January in this building here.
Mm-hmm. Sitting here at Center Stage with Steve Regal, William Regal, Darren Matthews, whatever you want to call him, where they used to do WCW television tapings. So what was your opinion of WCW over the years?
I loved that when I first got there. The only problem I had with WCW wasn't their problem, it was me.
Hmm.
When I went off the rails, then...
Yeah.
But that's my fault.
Right.
I can never... WCW, you know, there's obviously the organisation thing and that, but I got paid every week. They brought me to America. I got to wrestle the best people around at the time. You know, when I came here, you go back and look at the history of what I was doing here. First off, Ricky Steamboat, 6 months.
Yeah.
Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, Terry Taylor. I had nothing but, you know, I had a lot of people I had to work with who couldn't really do anything. And I had to put them in, which my style worked great with, putting them in and out of things
yes.
and making them look good. Unfortunately, that only worked for about 18 months when I was on with a lot of the guys that weren't so good and I was doing that style. It worked a few times round the loop. But then a lot of fans started figuring it out because they used to think, well, how come they can wrestle when they're on with him? But,
gotcha.
And so a lot of people started cheering me, so I stopped doing a lot of that wrestling stuff because that was never
they
my job.
They knew you were in control, yeah.
But it wasn't my job. It's not my job to get cheered. That's my job to make people not like
yeah.
it. I did that program with Larry Zbysko, which we did a thing here, which was a big deal. That drew some big number for the Saturday night show and stuff.
Well, like you said, I mean, you had the real ability to make everyone look good, but once in a while, that would, if someone couldn't follow you, things would fall apart. We talked about the Goldberg match, the big controversial match where you shot on Goldberg. That's not what happened. True. It's not even close to what happened.
No, absolutely not. And if you watch that and you can't see the difference.
I just watched it the other day.
Right, yeah. And if you can't see the difference in that, that's just not knowledge of what I'm under no illusions as to what I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I have had a few scuffles outside the ring in my time. I've never once tried to put somebody in an headlock or tried to give them an uppercut, right? And if you don't see what I'm trying to do in that, and unfortunately something's happened where Bill has a different idea of that.
But not even Bill. I mean, at the time, the WCW office got mad at you. You might have even gotten... Did you get fired because of that?
Plus,
you were off the rails, too.
So. I was off the rails. Yeah. I deserved being fired before that.
Right.
I mean, that night, I remember it very clearly because I was completely clear-headed on that particular night.
In El Paso?
In El Paso, because I'd just come back from a seven-week suspension when I got put in jail in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So... period of time, there was a few things. I was off the rails in 97 and 98. Like, there was a good 18 months where I was completely off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
I've just thought of something. I'm going to let the people know that I call you Noddy.
Mm-hmm.
And I call you Noddy. I've always called you Noddy from the first day I met you.
Why did you call me Noddy?
Because my favorite band as a child was Slade.
Right.
And as you know, and the lead singer, Noddy Holder, incredible front man, was one of those big influences on me. Never wanted to be a musician, but just the way that he carried his like persona. Well, he always had the big sideburns, and they were a glam rock band as a little kid that I was a big fan of. And so you had the sideburns.
Nod,
or you just reminded me of him anyway, the way you carried yourself, and you're like, Noddy. This is one of those other things. I don't know if this had anything to do with me getting fired, but the night after the Mike Tyson...
Holyfield
match.
Biting the ear off?
Biting the ear. I flew into Vegas because we had Nitro on the Monday night there. And I went out with Don Fry because I knew Don from being in New Japan with him. And we had a bit of a wild night. And Brian Johnson, the first time I'd met Brian, and we were out in a club, and I'm only ever going to incriminate myself any time I ever talk, but I was somewhat medicated,
mm-hmm.
and as I was at that time, unfortunately, and drinking a lot. And we were in this club, and Don just leant over and messing about, just little tiny headbutt on Brian Johnson. Next thing, we're surrounded by all these doormen, right? I mean, a proper big team.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, I'm under no illusions about what I am. But Don's like, stood up. I've stood up next to him, right? Honestly, I know what kind of a state I was in them days. A good gust of wind would have knocked me down, never mind anybody else. So all of a sudden, there's this like bit of a standoff, and Don's just walked through them all, and me thinking, being delusional and whatever else I was doing, I've like strutted out like I'm the Queen of Sheba next to him, you know what I mean? Like, look at me, you know I'm what? They could have all just ripped me to pieces, but Don had that thing about him.
Yeah,
right? They wouldn't have even known me, but they'd have all known Don at that time. Well, I get back to the hotel, it's like 5 o'clock in the morning. I just realised 6 o'clock. I've got a pickup in the lobby to go and do a load of radio interviews. Ooh. Cold shower, new suit, out.
Sunglasses. Pick me up.
Oh yeah, proper done, innit? Yeah. So it took me to the outskirts of Vegas, and there was this like big concrete building in the desert. Really, what's this? This is where there's four radio stations all in this one building, right? So we go in and we do the country stage, Nitro Tonight, usual stuff, and the rock, the last one's the rock station. And I walk in, and I look at this DJ, and he's grinning away, and he's got this big, stupid, full air band wig on, and it's a real obvious wig, and I'm thinking, I know this fella, and I don't like him, and I don't know why. And it's just like, I know him. Why would I know him? And it's all this stuff's going through me. Why would I know this fella here? And I don't know why I don't like him. So I'm sat down and I'm doing, yeah, we're at, you know, the MGM tonight, blah, blah, blah. And he, so what bands did you like as a kid? You know, and so we start talking. I went, oh, I like Slade. He went, oh, yeah. He said, I know those guys. And I went, and then it hit me all of a sudden who he was. He was the singer out of Quiet Riot.
Right.
Kevin Dubrow.
Who had a huge hit with two Slade songs.
Right. Yeah. So he went, he said to me, I made those fellas a lot of money.
Ooh.
And I went, this is live on the air, right? I went, pardon? He said, I made those fellas a lot of money. I said, don't you think they made you a lot of money? And he went, what? I said, well, the only hits you ever had were Slade songs, so they made you a lot of money. You didn't make... And I'm like, it's before that, right? And he's gone, no need to be like that, man. And I went, before I knew what I was doing, like still half drunk, dove over the top and I've got him by the throat. I've got him by... This is live on air. I've got him by the throat. And I'm going... I said, I'm going to knock this stupid wig off your head. Like I said, a syrup, you know, it's just rhyming slang for a wig in England.
Yeah.
Knock this stupid syrup off your head. And I called him all kinds of things. And the person who was with, he's live on air, right? He's going, ah. And the person from the WCW, whoever, I forget who it was, but the PR person just whispered in my ear, I think it's time to go now, Steve. And I went, I think you're right. And oh, you know, like that, there's that instant hit of, oh, dear, what have I done? And how stupid. And I just did the walk of shame and walked out of there. So that was another thing. And then me just being me at the time, I think, helped me get fired from WCW.
Kevin Dubrow got you fired from WCW.
No. Well, there was a combination. But Eric did the right thing.
Well, I mean, and the thing is, they gave you a lot of chances there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There's no, you know, listen... You'll never hear me complain about anything that I do. It's all down to me. Just don't make excuses for yourself. That's the, you know, you do what you want. You've got problems. There's no reason that you have to do what you do. It's just excuses.
Right.
It's got nothing to do with your family history or your genetics or whatever. Yes, that plays a part, but it's still down to you. It's a choice whether you've got to just stop making excuses for yourself. So I never make excuses for myself. If ever I've got a problem, that's me because I've let myself make an excuse for it.
Right.
So I'm not, you know, I haven't got any time. I hate when people say to me, oh, you know, it was great, you know, you got out of all that. And I went, not really. I shouldn't have been doing it in the first place. Right. Don't be congratulating me for doing
something. But you are
I
one of the
doing.
Few guys that was able to stop and stay stopped.
Yeah.
What was the final straw? Was it a rehab?
I went to rehab, and to be honest with you, there was only one person in there that kept me from, you know, in it, because I didn't buy into a lot of the, you know, like, my head wasn't clear. You know, your head's not clear.
If your head isn't clean, you'll never get off the stuff.
I decided that I wasn't going to do any more of the pills and the drinking and that before the day that I went in, but I still had holding on to other stuff, right? And I got myself in trouble while I was in there and whatever. But it was... When I got, after 10 weeks, I got myself in trouble in there one day, and I woke up out of that, and I just went, that's it. There's no big revelation, there's nothing, certainly no bright lights, and it's just me. I just went, it's just stop being such a dickhead, you know what I mean? Just stop doing it. I'm probably lucky that that's happened to me, but you know, like, that I can do that, but that's the way I am, you know. I suppose it's easy. It's easy for me to tell anybody anything, right? It's easy for us to get, you live life, and you've got to live life and get on with it the best way you can, but that was it, and I just, that's it, I've had enough, and you know, and that's been it, you know what I mean? I mean, I've
never looked back.
I've been suspended twice, but it's not because I've ever, you know, anybody, there's probably, I know there was a few things about me getting different, but oh, he's gone off the rails again. If I had, I'd have been thrown back into rehab, or I'd have got fired or something, right? So whatever you've heard, that's not the case. We don't need to get into
deep. You know, as far as I know, I've known you since 96. Exactly. I knew you when you were messed up, and I've known you since you've been sober. And
I came out of there in 99, and look, WWE without doubt saved my life, because I went to work for them and I was a complete wreck. Luckily, not luckily, really, people there who knew me before, because they didn't realize
like
I'd
Triple
gone through Triple H and Austin and people that you know I'd known for a few years before, and Jim Ross, definitely Jim was a big help to me. They didn't know that I'd gone off that path, you see. They hadn't seen me till I got there. And so when I got there, and then I was only there a short period of time, and then they put me into rehab. Well, once I had the problem after the 10 weeks in there, they said, well, we're going to let you go, but you're welcome back once you get your life sorted out. So I stayed I finished the thing off there 4 weeks, but that was it. I could have gone home that day. It wouldn't have mattered. That was the end of it. Once I just went, that's it. I've had enough.
Enough was enough.
And so Eric was good enough. You know, that's where you're going back to the WCW thing. Eric, David Penza reached out to me and said, Eric said that you're out of rehab and do you want a job back? So I went back there, and unfortunately I went back and it was... You know, things were done.
Because you had shown up in the WWE as the man's man thing, then went back to WCW again.
I was happy that they gave me. They didn't owe me anything, and Eric was good enough to give me a job back. He got rid of me when I was no use to anybody. He should have got rid of me before he did.
Yeah,
there's no excuses for. You know, there's nothing clever about. You know, it makes for some good stories, and it's funny some of the things. You know, we can go on all night about some of the things I got up to in that period of time. There's nothing clever about it. There's nothing smart about any of it.
Right,
and I'm not. I don't regret anything I've ever done. I don't regret one thing in my life. Nothing, because to me, if you live in the past, you die every day. Mm-hmm. You'll just eat your head. That's what happens with a lot of people. They just can't get over it. I've done something, but I don't regret. It's just it is what it is, right? I can't. Mm-hmm. I can only go forward. I can't keep worrying about what I've done.
What did you find as the differences between WWE from WCW when you came back clean? You went back to WCW, you said things were falling apart.
Yeah.
Then you came into the WWE, and that's when you were William Regal.
Yes. It's the organization, isn't it?
Yeah. Who's the boss?
Yeah.
You
know, just the professionalism and the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, when we were in WCW, everybody used to talk about the ones that had been there that came into WCW always used to, they talk about going to the show,
mm-hmm.
right? That was the expression at that time. And you understand it within, if you got half a brain, within 10 minutes of being there. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
This is the show. Mm-hmm. This is how it should be done.
This is the big leagues.
This is the big leagues. This is how it should be done. And I I love the time in WCW I had that I can remember. Any only problem was that, you know, that's that period of time when that was all down to me. So a lot of the things that I hear people talk about, nothing clever about it, but I can't remember a lot of it because I purposely, you know, if I wasn't doing anything, I wasn't involved in anything, unfortunately, I was sat in a back room somewhere, not quite with it. So, you know, I haven't got anything bad to say about WCW at all, and really haven't, because when I was good, they used me good.
Mm-hmm.
There is definitely that thing where I was as good as it got for a while there, and because of the money you were making, you couldn't get any higher.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one, but I still don't, that's the way it was.
Yeah.
This is the way I've always looked at this job. I was told when I started, the day one that I started, Bobby Baron, who started me, said, you come into this job with nothing and you go out with nothing, and don't ever forget that it's a bent business.
Bent meaning it's a work?
Bent meaning, crooked business.
Mm.
If you want to do something real, go to the Olympics.
Yeah.
So you're only, you know, it doesn't matter how good you are, certain circumstances will keep you in a certain, and that's the way it is. So I've always been there, because I'm not competitive, I've looked at it as a career, and okay, well, it's frustrating and it's whatever else, but I've always had this ability in my head to be able, and literally as I'm having a conversation, in my head I can step out of the situation and go, take a breath, look around, this is what it is, okay. And my saying that I always, people around me, let's just make it work. Mm-hmm. Whatever situation we're in, whatever we get to deal with, let's just try and make it work. Is it going to work great? Probably not. Hopefully, yes. But let's just make whatever situation work and not get et up about it and not get mad about it. And I suppose I'm lucky like that I can do that. Because, you know, everybody's different.
Right.
I can do that. I can mentally do that. Look, I know what this is. I'm in the entertainment business. It is what it is. If I get you, I try and be as good as I can.
Mm-hmm.
Am I always as good as I can be? No, but it's not through ever not putting the effort in.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of whatever is going on at the time. And it's not because of anything or letting my outside business get into it. When I was on the drugs, that was my problem. But like when I started in WWE, you know, I go back now and it's hard to watch me when I came in there, because I was trying to be, I wasn't me.
Yeah.
because I'd just been in a lot of trouble. They were good enough to bring me back, and I
didn't have the confidence.
It's not so much the confidence. It's not that I didn't have the confidence. I did have the confidence. I didn't want to ruffle any feathers.
I got
to do stuff with you, and me and you just go out and do a stuff.
Because that's us.
I can't work. I can't go at it the way I go at it with people that can't do that. And if that's not, I didn't want to eat people. You know what I mean?
Totally. Like,
I used to have it all the time off Dave, off Fit, and off Chris even. Why are you working down to everybody? Mm. Why are you just allowing yourself to be one of them, just another us? And I know it's a big silly thing. There was the confidence thing of me not wearing a robe.
Hmm.
Honestly, that is my security blanket.
Wow.
I was never the same wrestler ever when I couldn't wear. There was a time in WCW where I was asked not to wear it, and that was not me.
Hmm.
When I came to WWE, I was, you know, it wasn't the thing to wear the robe. I watched myself walking. To me, you know, it's just how good you are in the ring. If you walk through that entranceway and people make their mind up by the time halfway down the ramp,
whether they're
going to buy into you, right? The rest of it's a bonus. If you happen to be good in there, as long as you can make... Because I never bought into that, all that, who's a good worker and all that. To me, good workers are people who draw money.
Mm-hmm.
I've never drawn a penny. Good workers are people who can connect with your audience, right? And that's all it is. The rest of it's a bonus.
Hmm.
Some people don't have to do anything. They can do the exact opposite of the right things to do, but it still works good for them. That's what good work... They've outworked everybody, right? It's the whole concept of what working is, the real term of working is to engage your audience and to draw emotion out of them. And
connect with the crowd.
And that's what it is. So we sort of get carried away in our job. And my whole thing was never to be... I never thought of it about I want to be one of them great wrestlers. I always used, because I was working in nightclubs at 17 because I worked so many shows around Blackpool or near Blackpool, I could be back home and working in a nightclub at 10 or 11 till 2 and 3 to make some extra money. I was around a lot of real people, right? And a lot of my friends, I never really, it was always around a lot of fellas that were some pretty handy fellas. And when they used to say, that was how I built my whole act up of my work was, yeah, but when those wrestlers do that, it looks like that. So I used to think, well, I'm going to work on my stuff so it doesn't look like that.
Right.
If you say, yeah, but they go, and stamp the foot, you're never going to see me do that because that's wrong. Not that I don't do it now. As soon as I heard it, though, that's what I do. Like when I'm at all these things you do, these incredible opportunities that this business gives you to interact with your audience, I use it as a learning tool. Everybody that comes up to me and an autograph signer, I ask them what they like or what they don't, or what, if I'm working on something in my head, what do you like, what don't you like, who do you like, why don't you like that, and I get feedback like that, and I go, okay, well, if I get enough people saying, well, they don't like when people do that, I think, well, I'll try my best not to do that.
Right.
And it was built up
unique,
over the years of trying to be... And like a lot of the times, the stuff that I did was... I know it wasn't the best, but it was different. I know it might not be the best match, but like that match we had at WrestleMania, the first one, we went out and at the time, people may have gone, there was nobody hitting each other like we were hitting
each
other. It was like a different style. I did stuff with Edge that may not have caught the world on fire, but there was nobody doing anything like it at the time.
Yes.
And I wanted the big audience, not sort of... Because I'm a wrestling fan, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a wrestling fan, I've grown up loving wrestling. I love wrestling. I watch any kind of wrestling from around the world, but I don't judge it. There's no right and wrongs to me when I'm watching it from a certain place. That's what they do there. It's what works for you, for the people who are paying you and the audience that you're working towards. You have to make them connect with you, right? So... I wanted the bigger audience. As a wrestling fan, we're very forgiving. We stop seeing a lot of the detail because we like moves or we like different things or we like whatever you like, right? You like a certain pace of a match. But I've always looked at it from when I came to WWE. I can spot wrestling fans. I can walk out, and by the time I'm a third of the way down the ramp, I've figured out everybody in there because that's what I can do that. I learn how to read. And if there's more women and children in there, I'm not going to go out doing a lot of auditing stuff because they don't want to see that. They want to see entertain. Sometimes Eddie used to do that, and I used to do it, but I'm better actually seeing it. Eddie could do it just listening. He'd listen at the curtain and he'd go, it's probably 80% women and children tonight. Let's not go out and do serious. Let's do more entertaining stuff. Oh, it's more male crowd. Let's go out and do a bit more serious stuff tonight. And so that's what I go out and I'm looking and I go, well, there's a group of young teenage wrestling fans or, you know, young males. That I'll just put enough in for them to go, oh, that looks the odd suplex or whatever. But then most of the crowd is families with children and that they're going to want more entertaining. But my thing was always to work to a fella, right? Wrestling fans are wrestling fans. They're going to, you know, I'm one of them and I'm going to come and I'm going to watch wrestling. WWE's made up of so few wrestling fans that believe it or not. You know, in a major audience, that all they know is what they see.
Yeah.
So they don't know who's good and who's bad, right?
Right.
If you want proof, if anybody wants proof of that, if you listen to the wrestling world, the wrestling bubble, they'll say, oh, great Kelly is what he is. You watch how not good he is when he walks out in front of our audience.
Yeah.
Our audience love him.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the difference.
That's a great point.
So I always work to the man.
Well, isn't that what it's all about? Yeah. Working to the crowd, connecting with the crowd. Let me ask you a quick question. You mentioned Chris a few times, Chris Benoit.
Yes.
You just mentioned Eddie. I'm not going to say who was better, but working with them both, and you had great matches with both of them. One of the few guys that, to this day, have worked with both. What were the differences between Chris and Eddie, style-wise?
Believe it or not, I didn't wrestle Eddie too much.
Mm-hmm.
We only had a few short TV matches, and they weren't very good. And you know, and this is an awful thing to say, because we're both trying too hard.
Yeah,
because we've
had that before.
We both tried too hard because we actually wrestled each other on TV before we ever wrestled each other on live event, and we were trying too hard to impress each other. I think that I'm good at my job, and we were stumbling a bit, and it just wasn't quite right. But on live. It's two different animals altogether, isn't it? Because me and Chris had the way that we worked, and I wouldn't have certainly worked that way with
Eddie. You worked very strong style with
very
Chris.
Strong
very
strong style.
Very technical.
Yeah, and very hard hitting. And that was all down to... And that goes back to that thing, and I always work... It's the same thing. I work to the fella who's brought his wife and his children who doesn't probably want to be there. Because I know I can keep everybody else happy, but I think as long as he goes away and goes, that wrestling's whatever it is, but
those guys were
that fella looked like he was beating somebody up.
Right.
And, you know, if you go to the movies, you don't want to see the stuntman jump out of the helicopter. You want to buy into whoever's ever in there. So I know I can't do a lot of things. I'm not good at a lot of things, so I just try and do what I can. It might not make for the greatest of matches all the time, but you can never go away and go, that looked phony, or that looked... You know, luckily I get by. Most of the time I've got by in the WWE because I can entertain. I can pull faces, I can talk, I'm incredibly comfortable with myself as a person. So I will fall on my backside and make a bigger fool of myself than anybody who's ever done it, right? And I'm happy to do it because I know I can pull it off. And I'm comfortable in doing it. I'm just knowing, you know, I've got nothing to prove to anybody. But Eddie, once me and Eddie got it, we used to do some, like, really... change things up, and we worked on live events. Just, you know, back to that thing again, make everything you do mean something else, don't bother. I always challenge people, why are you doing that move? This is just it's a pro wrestling move, like a drop down. And people say, well, you're trying to trip somebody. No, you're not. How can you drop in 10 feet in front of me? Eddie used to try to trip people.
Yeah, just drop down.
Throw himself at, to me, the worst thing I see in wrestling drives me if I'm watching it, if I'm just watching for wrestling, I don't pick this stuff up. If somebody's telling me somebody's the best in the world or they're great at this, and I see somebody shoot somebody in by the arm and then drop down and leapfrog them, it drives me nuts because you're in control when you've got somebody by the arm, right?
Right.
So why do you need to get out the way? Because a regular drop down, you're just avoiding contact because you don't want to get it again, right? You're not stupid. Or a leapfrog's the same. If you have that mentality of why am I doing these things, then you register them and sell them better.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells better stories because that's all storytelling should be. Somebody who's never seen wrestling before, does it make sense to them? No different than going to the movies and watching a fight scene. You can do some things that are incredible, but as long as they're done for the right reason at the right time, it works.
Yeah.
And that's the way I go on storytelling and like moves and stuff, right? So Eddie was the one guy that used to actually try to trip somebody.
With his drop downs, great point.
Two different moves altogether.
That's a great point.
How are you? That's one of those things I learned years ago when I was a teenager.
why do them fellas, why do they just run over them when they drop down and they just they low on the stomach and they run over the top? Why don't I just stop and kick them in the ribs or in the head? Yeah, why don't we? Because you don't.
Right.
Most of the time, fellas are doing that. They're not even looking at the fella coming off the ropes. There's no... That's the detail of that kind
it's
of stuff.
Worrying about the next move rather than right. being in the moment.
So, like, back to this, me and Eddie. Eddie used to do that thing where he'd... And I would actually... I'd take my ankles out.
He'd come on an angle.
Yes.
And instead of just going flat, he'd come shoot himself out at you.
I would actually trip on him and, like, start selling an ankle. And he'd chase after it and then get that look of, like... And that... Because that's the kind of matches that me and Robbie used to have. Or, you know, like, a lot of the... Terry Rudge as well. And when you're having those competitive wrestling matches where it was like you'd do the nice stuff to start with and then there'd be one move and you wouldn't, nobody would turn villain, but there'd be that chasing after a body part and that look of frantic trying to get away from and snatching things, and me and Eddie could work like that. Me and Chris did the other stuff, which was to make people go,
they're beating the shit out of each other.
but people would say that. Yeah, you know, I mean, he probably hit me less than he did anybody else. It's just, you know, there's a perception of, but we just did different stuff, and that was all it was. It's just, it's never, I know that's not the right, because you're the master of making the best reaction at the right time and getting the best falls. I can't put matches together. If I'm on with somebody, great, like I work with you, but just... I know that you can put the you'll know exactly when to do the right foot. I just go out and work. I just do me, right? And I can luckily get through a lot of the times. If I'm on with somebody who can add those little bits of something, then it becomes something magic. Otherwise, it's just what it is. But there's going to be that believability. There's going to be all the entertainment thing to it. Like I say, one thing I've been very blessed with, I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not. And a lot of people
but
don't.
But that's the secret, though.
Well, that is, yeah.
You know, focus on what you do best and don't do what you don't do.
Yes, yeah, so like, until I was about 38, I didn't figure out how to work in the WWE.
In what way?
I didn't really figure it, because I wasn't quite myself.
Oh.
And once I got the robe back, I started wearing a robe again. The difference of comfort level, and
did
I'm
you
not
have
looking
to go
at,
request that from Vince, or you just started wearing it?
I can't remember, but even some of the... Like the stuff I did, I mean, you know, I work with certain people, it's always like, but I go back now and I'll go, just watch me walking out. I'm just not comfortable. And I get in the ring and I'm not myself. Yeah, some of the stuff's good and that, or decent anyway. But it wasn't until I started the robe where then, I come through the curtain and I'm like this animated more, and I'm not this rigid thing coming
that
to the
ring. That was your security blanket.
And boom. As soon as that's, and I always say it's like a joke, but. No, it's the best bit of my act. The robe's the best bit of my... It might as well just... I wish I could keep it on for the whole match, right? Because once I take that off, it's downhill from there onwards. But like on live events, another thing that I think I have the kind of reaction and the following I get from people now or talk to me, because I was never a great TV wrestler unless I was on with people like yourself who could put the right things...
You like to build and take your time.
Build my time. But I was a live event guy. Right, I mean,
because
I was the, you know what I mean. I made a name for myself at what they call a grassroots level. Everybody that saw me on a live event, as long as there was no reason, you know, sometimes that, you know, if they needed a short match or, but if I was under no constraints, those people got the money's worth out of me. I would have them screaming, I'd fall on my face and make them laugh at me, and then I'd turn it round and then they'd boo, and you build, and all it is what we do. We're an act like any other act, right? We're the only act in the world where people can boo you, but in the back of their minds, they still love you if you've built up that trust with them, because they trust you with their time to entertain them. And the likes of the ones who got, like the fellas now, that doesn't matter what's happening with them on TV, the fellas like Brian, Sheamus, Claudio, Antonio Cesaro, they're the fellas that are going to stay over, because they go out every night on live events and they leave every bit of everything they've got in that ring, and people come away and go, I don't know about anything else, but, and they start talking about it, and the grown men as well, they'll tell that stuff, they look old, but that fella, God, he looks like he's getting, whatever it is, you know, you build up that trust over, and it takes years to go around a few times,
it does,
all the ring, but you go around and that, you get that, where no matter what's happening to you, you go out and you get big reactions and people react to it, or you can just, and once you've built up that trust, as you know, I've probably been beat 85% of my career, right? But you can, I'm very confident that I can do it different on TV, but I'm like, you can walk in and I can say to somebody, what do you want me to be tonight when I go out?
What?
What do you want me to be? And I can guarantee I can change it three times by this. Or depending on how long the walkway is, I could just walk out and snarl at somebody, but then I'll like trip on my own self and like get a bit flustered, and then I'll laugh, and then I'll look at them and I'll just smile and just shrug my shoulders. What an idiot I am. And then they'll all go, yay! And then I'll just smile. And you have that ability because they trust you with the time.
Yeah.
And that's all it is. You build up trust over time with people.
Let me ask
some
you,
people could do it from day one, right? But you, I couldn't. You had to work on every detail of it. Yeah.
Let me ask you. I got to ask you two final questions.
Yeah.
When you were the general manager, we talked earlier, so many great moments. Is there one bit that stands out to you that you say, oh, that one was really funny?
My favorite bit that I ever did, I honestly don't know who else was in it. But there was me and Mr. McMahon, and there was some other foreigners in there. But they're talking away, and I looked at him, and I just went, bloody foreigners. And he like, double-took at me. And it just, you know, and I'm stood there, like, just, like, shaking my head, bloody foreigners. And he was just the look. He looked at me like that and just double... Did
the Vince McMahon look,
yes, the double-took. But he wasn't like it was so... And, still to this day, I've never seen it since. I saw it. The only reason I know us because I saw it on the monitor. You know, when they show you filmed it, did you like it? And another time was I was working with you. Because you remember that match we had at WrestleMania? I had a black eye. You remember?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
It's because I picked a dwarf up for a suplex and he punched me in the face. Remember that? So remember the thing with the dwarf, and I hit the dwarf off the thing, and I picked one of his. I picked him up for like I was supposed to suplex him, and his hand come bosh right in the eye, right, and swelled on my eye. So, unless I'm getting things confused, but I think that's what it was, right? There was something.
Yeah, the black. Like. I also love the fact that you had a T-shirt that said "Besmirched."
Yeah,
but don't right. besmirch me. Yeah.
So there was a thing with Al Snow, because I was doing something with Al Snow as well at the same time as you, because he was trying to be
the general manager or something. Yeah, lots of stories.
I could have this all mixed up, but anyway, there was a thing with Al Snow in Vince's office and me, and all these dwarfs come running through my legs, and you know, people don't. I have had very little written for me over the... I just ad-lib a lot of stuff and makes best of situations on a lot of that. And that it was always nice that you had the trust of the writers to that. Brian
of the boss,
Brian was my man, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like he loved doing stuff with me, but he'd just say, do your own stuff. And so you do all these little bits of business, strictly because I've been a huge comedy fan. So I've got all these little things that I've watched for years. Oh, I'll keep that, or I'll keep that, I'll try a bit of that and play with it, right? So all these dwarfs come running through my legs, and I just went... There must be a circus in town. And it cracked me up for some reason or another. And it was one of the few times I ever lost it, because I'm pretty good at one-take right? Yeah. And I just started giggling. That was it. And I was proper done in, you know. And they're all and I look around like that, and there's like however many there were, all these little people, and they're just staring at me like I dropped out of a dog's backside, like, you know. You know, it's not like bad enough being like, and you're just mocking us. You know? No, sorry, fellas.
Now, last question. Yeah. I mean, you've had so many matches over the years. I'm sure it's hard to even answer this. But if you had to pick your top one or two or three favorites, which ones stand out in your head?
Number one match would be against Robbie Brookside in Brighton, England, 1991. We did a 6 5-minute round wrestling match, and there was loads of old wrestlers in there who, you know, cynical old wrestlers. It was the first time I ever had a standing ovation from the entire audience doing a wrestling match, and all the old wrestlers stood up and we had a standing ovation. And we were pretty well known for doing that around the buildings, me and Robbie, when nobody did that. You know, because a lot of them
great
English fellas could do it. There's history of fellas, but of our generation, we were the ones doing that. And then the second one would be a match against Edge at the Yokohama Arena. I think you were there. We opened the show
up. That's right.
And we tore that. That was the one night that I really went, like, this is me. This is about as good as it's ever going to get here.
Yeah, that was our first time back in Japan.
We were the first match
10 years or so.
That was after our program, actually, and we had that match, and we really did some.
I remember that night was a great crowd.
And there were the foot rumbling.
Hitting the stands.
You know, there's a lot. just that many things over the years, you know, but it's mad, isn't it? I mean, I worked out the other week. You know, I haven't been wrestling much the last nearly 2 years, but I worked out from 1984 until 2 years ago. I had 28 years. I've done 31 mm-hmm. now, so 30 full-time, including a year off when I got sick after I went to India. Three different suspensions, two in here, and which were 3 months and 7 weeks in WCW, and injuries, I've had less than 2 years off.
Wow.
I mean, and that's, there's very few people could say yeah. that I'd like 26 solid...
You had non-stop work.
26 solid yeah. years, and I mean, a list of... I'm just a bit player in the wrestling job, but if you actually put a list up of the actual people I've wrestled over the, that'll never happen again.
Yeah, it'll never ever happen again.
There'll be no that's not a bragging thing. It's a shame for the fellas, because a lot of fellas come along now, they're going to wrestle the same 20 people.
That's true.
I mean, I've wrestled Antonio Inoki.
Yeah.
I mean, who's done that? You know what I mean? Like, just things. And I've wrestled Hulk Hogan, I've wrestled Steve Austin and The Rock, and stuff that you take for granted because you're who you are. I'm just a bit player, and like all them, that history of British wrestling, I was luckily there when all that Rocco and all them people were still about, and so I got to wrestle and then go to Germany with all the top fellas, and then South Africa, and when every these places were territories, and I was lucky, and it just lucky enough to be able to do it, and yeah. I've been very it's been a blast. Yeah,
well, it's been a blast having you. We could talk all day. We'll have to do it again and talk about all the other stuff, but I appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
It's a blast.
Thank you very much.
April 24th, Fozzy playing 37 Main in Atlanta. Johns Creek is the outskirts, name of the place. Get your tickets at FozzyRock.com. Your VIPs at FozzyRock.com. April 25th, Fozzy in Jacksonville doing the Welcome to Rockville Fest. We're going to be doing some dates with Slash as well. In May, the Concord Music Hall in Chicago. May 21st, the Stubbs in Austin. May 22nd, we're going to be in Beaumont, Texas. That's a Fozzy-only show. May 23rd, Houston. 24th, Dallas. Once again, FozzyRock.com for all information and VIPs, and then the big granddaddy. October 30th, we're going out with Kiss. That's right, Fozzy got the invite to play the Kiss Cruise 5. October 30th, setting sail from Miami to Jamaica with Paul and Gene, Tommy and Eric, and we are excited. A dream come true. So cool. Lots of great stuff going on. Thanks to all of you guys for making all of this great stuff happen, and thanks to the sponsors of Talk is Jericho, Burger King, Dollar Shave Club, DraftKings.com, TDP Yoga, NatureBox.com, and of course, Amazon. Thanks to you guys for supporting my sponsors and doing all your shopping through my Amazon links. I appreciate it. Easiest way to support the show so I can keep doing it for you for free for twice a week. You know how to find my Amazon guests. You go to podcast1.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page 8. Then you click on Talk is Jericho. You see all three of my Amazon links in the UK, the USA, the Canada. A. Every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to show so we can keep doing this for you for free for twice a week. No extra fees, hidden challenges. Just getting your shopping done. You help me out in the process. You're doing your thing. You're keeping me rocking. I'm keeping you rocking. And what a great, great week. So many cool things. And thank you so much for being here and listening. Next week, got some more big guests next Wednesday. Going to have The Miz on to talk about his new movie, The Marine 4, and then one of the greatest record producers of all time, Bob Rock. He produced a little-known record called The Black Album by Metallica. He did Dr. Feelgood by Motley Crue. He did Sonic Temple by The Cult, one of the greatest of all time. Loverboy, The Paolas, Michael Bublé. So many huge bands. He's going to be on the show to tell us about all of them, plus The Return of The Miz, one of my biggest number of guests. He's been on the show more times than almost anybody else. So join us on Wednesday, and until then, stay hard, stay hungry, stay cool, and keep on dancing. Yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com. Okay, keep your eyes closed.
Okay.
I want to show you my first ever painting.
All right.
Okay. Open your eyes.
Oh, that's a lot of colors mm-hmm. and shapes.
So be honest. What do you think?
Well, I like how if you switch to Geico, you could save hundreds of dollars on car insurance.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Here, why don't I hold your paintbrush while you call them?
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer. Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million, what color is the White House?
I know this.
5 seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay. Judges? That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo! Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Syria Peace Talks? I'm Ben Thomas with an AP News Minute. Syrian rebels have rejected peace talks being proposed by Russia. They're accusing Moscow of failing to pressure its ally, President Bashar Assad, to end the conflict. Christmas may be over, but the shopping isn't. Hazel Ginn was at Macy's Herald Square in New York today.
It's not too bad. Even we went up to the 9th floor, and we managed to get in a queue of about 4 deep, so not bad. Yeah, and then we went to another one, and it was only a couple, so we kind of timed it well, I think.
America's research group, which focuses on consumer behavior, projects holiday sales up about 5% this year. Harley-Davidson is placing a renewed emphasis on teaching people to ride as part of its efforts to attract more customers. The company is expanding the number of dealerships with a Harley Riding Academy. The move comes as the industry grapples with years of declining sales and an aging customer base. I'm Ben Thomas.